Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Ward Hannigan. Ward is the founder of ForeclosureForum.com. It's a website that's specifically for education of real estate investors, specifically trustee sale experts. Ward is the most recognized name in training other people to do trustee sales, and he's actually one of the most respected men in our industry. Ward, I welcome you to our show.
Well, thanks, Bruce.
Thank you, by the way, for all of your years of kind of dedication to our industry, and that reputation is no joke. I've never heard anyone say anything bad about you, so I really appreciate that. Ward, how did you say when you were trying to figure out what you were going to do with your life, I think I'll get involved in real estate investing?
Well, actually, I didn't say it that clearly. I wasn't that bright. And I was one of these guys that every family seems to have one that is, lives by his wits and he's bright, but people would say if he only stick to something long enough, and I'd get bored very easy. So when I graduated from college, I was recruited on campus by IBM, and I loved it while it was a novel, and I loved it while I was making more money than I ever made before up to that time. But then when they rewarded me with increased quota and cut my territory the second year, I felt like I had been robbed. I mean, I just felt, I was beaten down, and did it really floored me.
Hmm. So
I started looking around for something else, and I discovered that I didn't want to be a little minnow in a big pond like IBM. Fantastic company, fantastic benefits. They keep their word, all that kind of stuff. But I wanted to be, the big fish in a small pond. And so never again did I ever work for a very large company on purpose.
Now, you went on to become an attorney, correct?
Well, not right away. I went on to, I created a company called International Franchise Enterprises because I noticed every time I visited Tijuana, because I would be picking up my wife's relatives from flying up from Mexico City up to the Tijuana airport, that there's all kinds of Americans down in Tijuana, and it kind of about what they eat and drink. And I thought, wow, there's an opportunity here. And so I bought an A&W root beer franchise and went over to Santa Monica where they had their headquarters, and I negotiated purchasing the area franchise for Baja California Norte. So that was all of Mexico down to and including Ensenada and over to and including Mexicali.
Okay.
And then I put the world's largest A&W root beer stand in the world in Tijuana, and we did fantastic for the wrong reason.
Why was this?
I was so dumb. Well, I thought I was going to get a name that Americans would gravitate to, that they knew was a quality drink, A&W root beer, right?
Right.
And the Americans where I located the stand was on the busiest street going out to the racetrack. And they were so busy, they're not going to stop for a root beer. They wanted to get to the track before everybody else does. And the same thing going home, they wanted to get to the border. But the locals, I mean, absolutely fell in love with my root beer stand. And when it just was crazy. Police came out and had to control the lines of people trying to park underneath my umbrella. We had one of those old style outdoor areas where the gal would come up and hook your food tray on your window, your car window and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And so did that. I expanded my freezer. I turned into a full-time smuggler, smuggling food into Mexico. And I was one of these reverse guys. I smuggled 2,000 pounds of hamburger meat in a specially, air shock Dodge White Hat special down into Tijuana. But,
Now how long?
And then I started selling meat I started bringing extra meat in, and other guys, other restaurants were coming over and buying American hamburger from me. They didn't have to go across the border. And so I had a profit added to that because American meat has its PenFeds, this 21-22% fat in it, where Mexican meat is range-fed, and it only has about like 10% fat. And so it crumbles. When you want to cook a hamburger, when it all crumbles up if it doesn't have enough fat in it.
I got to tell you, I thought this would be the last topic we would be covering on today's show is you're smuggling hamburger meat to Mexico. Well, then, when did real estate come into play after about what?
Real estate came into play, actually. So when I got out of my interest down in Mexico, I came back and I didn't want to go back to live in Riverside, from whence I had come. I fell in love with San Diego, and I wanted to stay in San Diego. So I had an economics background. My bachelor's degree was economics. So I thought that would make me a great stockbroker. And so I went over and got a job as a trainee, as a stockbroker trainee in La Jolla with, what was it called, Shearson Hamel at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And I liked that, too, the novelty of it and this and that, until I found out that in order to prosper, I was going to have to fudge on a lot of things. That it just made me very uncomfortable. I just didn't know I was such a prude, but I could not stand lying to people. I just could not tolerate it, even though, as you know, I'm a first-class atheist. I just could not lie to people to make a buck. Just couldn't stand it. And I was... One of the worst things you could do is be ashamed of you. If you're ashamed of yourself, you're dead in the water. And I was so ashamed of myself, I couldn't stand it. And finally, went to the hospital because I was having hives and reacting to people about my lack of full disclosure and stuff like that, and it was true. And so finally, I decided because of my throat closed off, you get hives internally too, that I wouldn't be long for this world if I kept that up, so I quit.
You're an atheist that practices the golden rule. That's an interesting twist there, Ward.
Well, yeah, and it's funny. I've been the happiest guy ever since. I don't have to lie to anybody. And lying takes a lot of time. You have to keep your lie straight. You have to remember what you told Mr. A versus Mr. B, and yada, yada, yada. Oh, my God, it's horrible. It's horrible. Absolutely. And I just won't do it. I refuse to do it. You know. And I know what happens to me when I do something that's dishonest like that. And I don't want to go through it again.
So you went from stockbroker to trusty sale buyer or foreclosure buyer.
No.
Oh, okay.
I went from stockbroker to I saw an ad in the paper and Countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an ad in the paper for Countrywide, what was it called? Countrywide Funding?
Okay.
Or whatever.
Well, whatever.
And so I answered it. I didn't have a real estate license or didn't pay any attention to real estate. I thought real estate was something you use. You know, you just rented it for whatever, and on and on. Countrywide had formed in 1969 up in Los Angeles, and they spread out the very next year. The very first office that they opened up branch office was in San Diego. And so they hired two guys in San Diego, and I was one of them. And so I was a, what do you call it, mortgage solicitor.
Okay.
For Countrywide. And at first it was a joke because I thought there was no such thing as a Countrywide company. And so I thought I heard them wrong, and so I called it Countywide. And so when I reported to the company on the very first day for Countywide Funding or Countywide Countrywide Financial, I forget. But anyways, the secretary corrected me. She said, no, we're not countywide. We're countrywide.
So your stock
went up. I learned everything about, in those days, everything essential to making FHA and VA loans. And I memorized all of the qualifications for FHA and VA loans, which are the only kind of loans countrywide made in those days. They didn't make conventional loans. And I did extremely well with them. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being their boy wonder and blah, blah, blah. And Angelo Mozzillo was the guy that recruited me.
Really?
And he would get $10 million or whatever the hell it was from some investors in New York as his operating cash and create mortgages with it. And until he sold them back to Fannie Mae, he might have, you know, some shortage or thin times. And so they would furlough us a couple of times. And I got tired of that, being furlowed. And you didn't get paid while you're being furloughed. Mm. So they'd sit home and come back in a week and a half or 2 weeks. So finally I called up Angelo and I said, hey, Angelo, I'm sorry, but I'm moving on. I think you got a great company, and I think someday you're going to be fantastic, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, are you crazy? You're going to be one of our critical people, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, I just see guys I'm talking to all day long that don't know anything about real estate as salespeople, and they're making more money than I'm making, and I'm the one that helped put and hold their deal together.
So, Ward, you noticed that when you were working for Countrywide, the agents that were selling the real estate were making more than you were.
They were making a lot more.
Making a lot more.
So that intrigued me, nope. Yes. And so finally I got another time that I was asked to stay home for a while. I just told them, I said, listen, you know, I'm going to go get my real estate license and switch over to sales because I can see that they're making a lot of money, and I think I can do the same thing. So I had, Angelo call me, and literally couldn't believe that I was quitting because I was his star, you know, guy in all the offices. He had me coming up and demonstrating up in L.A. how I could sell term insurance, mortgage term insurance, you know, to almost 98% of the time and stuff like that.
Okay.
And it was so simple.
Well,
anyways, I switched and I went down. There was an ad in the paper, and I went to a company called Chula Vista Commercial Realty. They said, come, if you have no license, fine. No worries about that, and which I didn't have at the time. And Chula Vista Commercial Realty was fairly new down in the Chula Vista area. It specialized in selling apartments, 5 units or more.
Okay.
And that's how I got into the real estate. You asked me how I got into real estate business.
Okay.
That's how I got into real estate business.
What age were we right now?
What age am I now?
No, what age were you at that point when you're talking about making the transfer from?
At that point, I was probably in my late 30s.
Okay. All right, and you still had yet to deal with your first foreclosure property intentionally.
That's correct.
Okay.
In fact, yeah.
I think a lot of people would find that surprising, but also encouraging, is that they probably thought you'd been doing this for your entire life, and really you were almost 40 before you. Now you're not even into foreclosures yet; you're just about to make the brokerage scene. So, how long did you stay in the brokerage before you noticed the people that owned it were making more money than the agents?
10 years. I worked from 72 to 1982. I had broken off after about 4 or 5 years. I went off. I formed a company called Income Realty to telegraph I was only interested in rental income.
Right.
And I had my own office and stuff like that. But and I was making lots of money. But just again from the sales. The reason I was doing so well in sales is I convinced the sellers to carry a good portion of their sales price back and owner carry back. And of course that made a lot less down for new buyers to buy in and not have to qualify, go through bank qualifying. It just took subject to the existing loans and stuff like that.
Well, at the time, interest rates were climbing, say, from the mid-70s to that point. So the carryback financing was still probably a pretty good yield for the seller.
Well, it was a fantastic thing for the seller, too. Yeah, because he got no arguments about his price, or very few arguments, because not everybody would carry back. He wasn't licensed, so he couldn't charge points and loan fees and stuff like that.
So you're 49 years old and you haven't bought a thing yet?
Yeah, that's correct. I was 40. I was 49 probably, and I actually got into foreclosures in 19. Actually, got into foreclosure when I was 40. Let's see, 42. 1982. I was 42 years old.
Okay, 42.
And and I got into buying foreclosures, and I was intrigued with foreclosure because every once in a while, one of these people who had convinced to carry back, an owner carry back, a wraparound, would call me up and say, Ward, you know, you sold my apartment house 3 years ago, and I carried back a note, and that apartment house has been sold to somebody else and somebody else, and the current owner's not paying me. What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you have to foreclose. Well, how do I do that? So I started becoming quite intrigued with that, and so I, for my business, I had to know all the answers about foreclosure so that, these people would not take a loss because on something I suggested they do. And so the more intrigued I got, the more I started looking at it as that's a source of finding properties for investors. And but I wanted to do it on the side. I was way off base. I was thinking of that as an adjunct to my regular brokerage activity, and found out that buying foreclosures, investing in foreclosures, is a full-time business. There is no such thing as doing this part-time if you really want to prosper. And so, 1976, I subscribed to foreclosure notice service, and in a whole month, didn't even open up more than two of their envelopes that came. And envelopes came every single day with the paper notices.
Were they two colors at the time?
No.
We got a subscription to one. One was yellow and one was pink if it was in a trustee sale or NOD.
The paper, yeah.
Yeah, the paper itself.
No. Yeah, we might have had that too down here. But I got overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And since I was making good money in brokerage, I just canceled my subscription after 1 month,
mm-hmm.
and thought I'd get back to it. 2 years later, the business was bought out by somebody else, and the guy contacts all of the previous subscribers and says, "Man, I've made this simpler, faster. It's easier for you to get rich off of a foreclosure subscription we have. And my stepson is a computer whiz, and blah 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 blah." I fell for it, line, hook and sinker, and so I subscribed again. Same thing. I was overwhelmed with my real estate business, and I wasn't really giving it a serious attempt. And I just made a vow in 1978 I was not going to get into the foreclosure business unless I had a lot more time to devote to it. Well, didn't have to wait too long. In 1982, when interest rates went up to 16%, 17%, 18%,
mm-hmm.
The apartment absolutely died. It was killed. The industry was dead because, buying apartments is an elective. You don't have to have an apartment to live,
Mm-hmm.
You might feel you have to have a house. And so people would just fold their arms and say, I'm going to wait until this nonsense subsides and buy an apartment house when, mortgage rates are reasonable. And so I went from being overwhelmed to having nothing to do, and I thought to myself, foreclosures, all the time in the world. And so that's when I got into it in 1982.
When was the first time?
Ever since.
When was the first time you shared what you knew with someone else? So you've been training people for a while.
Yeah, I didn't share with anybody because I didn't have any tutors because there was nobody around that seemed to know anything about it. We'd have these carpetbaggers come down from L.A. or whatever and come to San Diego and have a freebie seminar on a Wednesday trying to gin up business for the weekend and for a course they had. And I'd look at their manuals and I said, this is nonsense. I'm not going to give $200 for this or something. And I knew the law on foreclosures at the time, and I knew that their manuals were out of date, and they didn't seem to know it. You know, the foreclosure laws are changing all the time. So, yeah, it happened this way. I guarded my what I knew as kind of like a corporate secret, and made up a manual that I could reference fairly quickly, you know, all the stuff I learned about raising cash, all the stuff I learned about regaining possession and researching the title of the property and rehabbing and all this stuff. And I was asked by Jack Fullerton. I didn't know Jack at the time, but he called me from Orange County, and that was in probably 3 years after I got started. It's probably around 84, 85.
Okay.
And he said, listen, you've been recommended as a person who might be able to act as a substitute speaker for me. I have a speaker arranged from IRS, and at the last minute he's canceling on me, and I've got a group of people that have already registered and coming. And I said, well, I don't know who gave you the idea. I was a speaker. I have not taken any public speaking classes. I'm not known as a speaker. I just, you know, we have a club, a local club here, and we only meet once a month amongst ourselves, and the members give their success stories to the other members, and we try to help out all the other members. You know, bring your deal, the most recent deal. And lots of times guys would be embarrassed, and so I was oftentimes asked to, well, Joe is supposed to speak tonight, Warren, he's not here, so could you give us your most recent foreclosure story? Well, sure, okay, right. And so I'd give him my foreclosure story. And and I told him, I said, I'm telling you, Jack, I think you're making a wrong move. I really don't have any experience whatsoever speaking. And he said, well, you're better than nothing. I said, okay, great. And I went up. And I gave a talk, and I got a standing ovation.
Wow.
And Greg Metcalf was in that audience. He was a 28-year-old guy that was, he doesn't mind me telling the story. He was so poor, he was living with his folks and very, very upset about it because he liked to be like his peers and driving fancy cars and all that. Anyways, I now know why stand-up comics, you know, go back to their roots and go to the comedy store and this and that. And they're multimillionaires, and they speak and they talk for nothing just to be back in that audience again and get the buzz that it gives you. And the minute it was over, I was just glowing. I just thought, this is fun. there was a man in the audience who was a coordinator for arranging speakers for a combined club up in Orange County called ACRE, which stood for Area Congress on Real Estate. And well, so I gave a talk to that group, and instead of 25 guys like Jack, it was over 200. So it was different. But to feel comfortable, I jumped off of the raised platform and left the microphone there. They didn't have wireless in those days. And just walked up and down the aisles amongst those 250 people, speaking a little louder. And it was the same thing. It felt fantastic because I was looking directly in the eyes of no more than about 10 or 15 people at a time.
Ward, let's leave that right there. We'll join Ward Hannigan again in the next segment. Thank you for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.